This lesson is from the course, The Theology of Heaven in the Book of Hebrews, taught by Dr. Lane Tipton.
As we continue, I have recently developed a corresponding doctrine to the indoctrination of the Spirit. I call it the incoronation of the eternal Son of God. In keeping with and now expanding Klein's formulation of the appropriate term to denote the Spirit's relation to the heaven temple, I have sought to coin a term that corresponds. The Spirit is indoxate in the heaven temple in the absolute beginning. The Son is incoronate in the heaven temple in the absolute beginning. Now, when I speak in terms of incoronation, incoronation is simply another way of speaking of enthronement. The Son is incoronate or enthroned in the heaven temple in the absolute beginning. And we need to see this as occurring at the same time of the Spirit's indoxation. In fact, my argument is this: the concrete personal reality that the Spirit illumines in indoxation when He fills the temple with glory, the concrete personal reality is that of the Son sitting on the throne of the Father, sitting at His right hand. When the indoxate Spirit illumines the heaven temple, it is the enthronement of the incoronate and eternal Son of God that gives it its focus. Now, I've lectured on this in other modules, so I want to give you only a brief outline, and you can turn to other lectures in Reformed Academy or Reformed Form conferences for more material. But Colossians 1:15b refers to the eternal Son of God as the firstborn over all creation. Greg Beale, a former colleague and friend of mine, in his insightful commentary on Colossians, observes that firstborn over all creation should be the preferred translation instead of firstborn of all creation. And he says that that translation captures the sense of the phrase in its context. For instance, in Psalm 89:11, firstborn over the kings of the earth is used to designate David and typify David's son and David's Lord, Jesus Christ. The use of firstborn here refers to a status of categorical exaltation above all that is created. The Son of God is the firstborn in the sense, verse 16, that He is the one by whom all things were created. Now that text in Colossians 1:15b and 1:16a pinpoints the personal and terminal work of the Son of God. He is exalted above the created order, as the Creator is exalted above the creature. This text also is a commentary on Genesis 1:1. In the absolute beginning, the eternal Son of God created the visible heavens, the invisible heavens and the visible earth. In the absolute beginning, the Son created that presently veiled and unseen realm we call heaven, and He also created the presently visible and seen realm of the earth. He entered into a new relation to creation in which the relation can change and the creature in the relation can change, but He, Hebrews 13:8, remains the same yesterday, today, and forever. And so, what does that bring into view? It brings into view the Son seated on the throne in heaven, firstborn over all creation, so that he is due worship and adoration and obedience as God. But in verse 16b, Paul expands that interpretation of Genesis 1:1 and focuses on a host of relations in heaven and on earth. Notice, we've already said this, but I'll just review it and then I'll develop it. In 16b, by him, the sum total of creation came to exist. Things in heaven and on earth, things invisible and visible. But if you look in 16c, you'll find Paul drawing in allusions now to Nehemiah 9:6 and to Isaiah 6:4 and to other related texts. By him all things were created, things in heaven and earth, things visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities. You see, given that 16b refers to Genesis 1:1, 16c expands on that absolute alpha point of creation, the filling of the heaven temple with divine glory, and the population of that heaven temple with angels. And it reminds us that the Son of God, as firstborn of creation, is exalted above all rulers, all authorities, all thrones, and all dominions, whether angelic or human. 1:16c brings into view his incoronation in the heaven temple over all created reality. The eternal Son of God, instantly upon creating the heaven temple, assumed the throne that was set on high. Jeremiah 17:12. A glorious throne was set on high from the beginning. And what is the witness of the New Testament? Of the Son, Hebrews 1:8 says, your throne, O God, endures forever and ever, and righteousness and justice are the scepter of your kingdom. Do you see the point? When the Son was incarnate in heaven, seated on that glorious throne set on high from the beginning, having laid the foundations of the heavens and the earth, he was incarnate as king, king over all creation. So how do we relate the incarnation of the Son to the indoxation of the Spirit? Here's one way. The indoxation of the Spirit without the incarnation of the Son is empty. The incarnation of the Son without the indoxation of the Spirit is blind. The indoxate Spirit fills the heaven temple with radiant and luminous glory, and that glory is the glory of the Father and of the Son as incarnate. Let me put that relation a different way that might prove illumining. Still now, I'm trying to expand and complement Klein's insight. The personal presence of the Spirit sanctifies heaven as a temple dwelling. The personal presence of the Son regalizes heaven as a royal dwelling. So there's a Trinitarian rationale for why heaven is construed as a temple of the Spirit and why heaven is construed as a dwelling of the King, the Lord. The Spirit sanctifies heaven as a royal temple. The Son regalizes heaven as a royal chamber. Now, it's precisely this reality in coronation, is precisely this reality that Isaiah saw prior to the incarnation of Jesus in Isaiah 6, 1 through 4. Read this text now in light of this doctrine of indoxation, and you will see something that perhaps you have not seen as clearly before. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord seated upon a throne, high and lifted up, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Above him stood the seraphim, with six wings, two they covered their face, two his feet, and with two he flew. And one called to another, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory." And the foundations of the threshold shook at the voice of him who called, and the house was filled with smoke. This text is an Old Testament expression in an expanded form of what Paul says in a compressed way in Colossians 1:16c. The Son is exalted above all rule, all thrones, all powers, all dominion. He is the Lord of hosts. He is the Lord incarnate. And it is his glory prior to and apart from the incarnation, his immutable personal glory that regalized heaven as a royal dwelling place. Now, three features from this text stand out in light of what we've said. First, notice that the fullest concentration of the glory of the Lord is in heaven, where the seraphim encircle the throne of the Lord. Yet, the whole earth is full of his glory as well. Why? Heaven and earth are very good, and the relation is positive, as we've seen. Yet, heaven is filled with the fullest and the most radiant expression of the divine glory. The seraphim must cover their eyes in the presence of this primordial, radiant, effulgent glory. That, in Voss's language, is the primordial dwelling place of God. Yet the earth is full of the glory of the Lord of hosts, but not in such a way that while on earth, Isaiah must cover his mouth or hide his eyes. In the primordial dwelling place, seraphim cannot gaze directly on the Lord's searing and luminous glory. In the secondary dwelling place, the visible things of heaven reveal his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, Romans 1:20. So, the primordial dwelling place of heaven has a resplendent glory fullness so great that the angels cannot gaze directly upon it. Yet the secondary dwelling place has a refracted and derived glory that fills the earth. The glory in the primordial heaven is archetypal, the heavenly original. The glory on earth is a shadowed down copy made known through visible created things. Second, notice that the dwelling place of the Lord in Isaiah is the temple. It's not the earthly copy where the cherubim are engraved on the mercy seat. It is the heavenly reality where living seraphim, six-winged angels, encircle the throne. The Lord is enthroned above the host in heaven, above the living seraphim who worship him. And the train of his robe fills the temple. So heaven is a holy temple dwelling where the Lord receives endless worship from those who are present. That is the nature of the primordial heavenly temple. It is a place of worship. And it confirms yet again the distinction between the primary and primordial heaven temple and the secondary earthly copy in the visible realm of earth. Isaiah is given a vision into that highest heaven, the glorious and permanent dwelling place of God. And as he peers into that place, he sees the archetype after which the earthly is a shadow and a copy. Third, in the very first statement of verse 1, Isaiah says that he sees the Lord sitting on a throne. This is what I term the heavenly incarnation of the eternal Son of God as he is seated on the throne of God in the heaven temple. His presence on the throne regalizes heaven as the dwelling place of God. His presence leaves a royal impress upon the throne where he is seated. The train of his robe fills the temple. Isaiah, later in 66:1, makes this distinction between the primordial and the secondary in this way. Heaven is my throne, and the earth is my footstool. That's the distinction between the primordial and the secondary. That's the fundamental distinction between the archetype and the ectype. The Lord of hosts, the Son of God, the pre-incarnate Lord, regalizes the heavenly dwelling place as he sits on the throne, receives the worship of elect angels, and fills that place with his glory and the train of his robe. Now, these three points then build on the two things we saw from Voss and Klein. From Voss, we learned heaven and earth are very good and their relation is positive. From Klein, we saw that heaven is filled instantly with the resplendent and radiant glory of the Spirit. And from the text that we've just surveyed, we see that the personal and concrete glory manifested in the Spirit's epiphanation is the Father and the Son incarnate at the right hand of the Father in the heaven temple. These two doctrines of the indoxation of the Spirit in heaven and the incarnation of the Son in heaven give us the beginning of a fully Trinitarian account of the way God's glory fills the heaven temple in the absolute beginning. The Father coronates the Son and the Son is incarnate. The Father and the Son indoxate the Spirit, and he fills that temple with the glory of the Father and the Son and the Spirit. And this realm is the primordial and permanent place where the fullness of the glory of God is set on display as the end of creaturely existence in worship. This is the foundation, the backdrop for what we're going to say about the ascension of Jesus Christ into heaven that's picked up and centered so much in the New Testament and in the book of Hebrews.
Thank you for watching this lesson from Reformed Academy. This is just the beginning. At Reformed Academy, we offer free, in-depth courses that will help you grow in your knowledge of God's Word. Join thousands of learners from around the world who are deepening their faith and engaging with rich, redemptive historical theology, all at no cost to you. Sign up today at reformedforum.org/academy and start exploring the unfolding message of Christ revealed in all the Scriptures.